Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. As Americans process the violence in Charlottesville, communities in Kentucky and Maryland address their own monuments to Confederacy. Pro-Confederate groups call for rallies in Texas and Virginia, and an entire nation contemplates the presence of neo-Nazis in the United States. In February, we talked with filmmaker Matt Ornstein about his documentary, Accidental Courtesy, on Independent Lens. It follows an aging African-American musician whose hobby is to befriend and convert members of the Ku Klux Klan and neo-Nazi groups in America. It's a controversial concept. Should those who preach racism and violence be treated with patience and respect? What is our moral responsibility in the shadow of hate? We'd like to bring you that conversation now with Matt Ornstein. We recorded this in February. Matt, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you so much for having me.
I have to start in an unexpected place, because let's talk about the soundtrack to this film.
Sure. I'm always happy to talk about that.
How fun is that? It's a great soundtrack throughout. Tell me why it was important for you to layer that sound in the way that you do.
Well, music's a huge part of Daryl's life, and it's often his first line of communication to some of these people in the film. They see him play, and they're captivated by that, and that's kind of his entry point. But then there's this other thing in the film, it's sort of like a thread through it and really deserves to be its own piece, but it's about pop music as the history of integration in America. You know, because you combine these classically black and white art forms and you get this thing that really changed the landscape. And so the music was always really important to us, and in the festival version of the film, we had a lot of songs that when we tried to actually license, it was just a staggering estimate. And so we got really lucky, and we already had some Charles Bradley songs in the movie, and the people at Daptone that do Charles and Sharon Jones, rest in peace, did our music, our score, and so the songs and the score kind of blend together, and I just love it so much. And yeah. Tom Brennick, if you're listening, really thank you again so much for everything.
And it gives paints a whole picture of sort of hopefulness for me too. In a topic about race in America that the conversations aren't always particularly hopeful, but then there is this soundtrack that sort of drives it to the next, the next location, the next conversation.
I totally agree with you, and it was important for us. You know, we don't want the film to be something that is homework. It's like you had your whole day, and then you have to sit through this as well. We'd like it to ideally be an enjoyable experience, and I think the music is the light that carries us through some of the darker places.
Yeah, let's talk about Daryl as a musician.
Sure.
You see him playing this flaming piano in his younger days. Tell me what is he like?
I mean, Daryl's a larger-than-life character, yeah. Clearly, as you could see from the movie, but he's also a tremendously patient man. And that's something that really was driven home to me through watching him work.
How did you get to know him and decide that you wanted to, follow his work?
I initially became aware of him through a newspaper article, and I was just sort of compelled by the uniqueness of his approach. I wanted to know why he did it, what he got out of it. I just had a lot of questions. And when I did finally manage to link up with him, I emailed him a few times. When we did link up, I was in New York, and I went down to D.C. to meet him, and he picked me up at the train station. And on the drive from there to his house, he started telling me some of the stories that would be the film. Hmm. And I knew by the time we hit the state line for Maryland that there was a film to be made here.
Yeah. He's a whopper of a storyteller. I mean, the man knows how to tell a story.
He's a raconteur.
That's right. Let's start with this story that he tells about being, and not to put you on the spot and make you recreate one of those dynamic stories owns and delivers so effectively. But he's a Cub Scout, and he's kind of, tell me a little bit about his background as a child, and then this moment at the Cub Scout parade in America that sort of changes how he sees himself.
So Daryl's raised abroad. His father is in the Foreign Service, and he's a diplomat. And Daryl's raised in this sort of utopian environment where there's kids of all different, you know, races and nationalities in a classroom, and they all get along, and then he comes back to America and is in school and is suddenly confronted with this reality that he hadn't had to previous to that. And the moment when it really crystallizes for him is when he's marching in a parade with his fellow Cub Scouts, and he starts getting things thrown at him, and then realizes they're only being thrown at him as the only black scout. And he goes home and asks his parents what's going on. Hmm. And that begins this journey that carries us up to now.
Yeah, there's this moment where his Cub Scout leaders surround him to sort of protect him, and they won't tell him the truth. He starts saying, you know, why is this just happening to me? And they just hush now, you know, don't worry about it. You know, get him off the street. They're protecting him from not only the flying projectiles, but from the truth at this point.
And there's a fascinating metaphor in that, because Daryl's immediate response was he didn't want to be protected from the truth. He wanted to know not only what was going on, but why. He wanted to know why they did that, which I think is still, if I had to boil down his quest to a single question, that might still be it today.
Right, that curiosity. So then let's talk about the nuts and bolts of this thing. His life, and it's been going on for several years, is to reach out to members of the KKK and white separatist groups and say, let's have lunch. That takes a certain amount of guts.
It does, and as I often point out to people, this is also sort of his hobby. This is his leisure time activity. He's a working musician. He plays a ton of shows every year, and then, you know, in his spare time, he does this outreach.
Yeah.
And when he does it, it's very interesting, because he approaches them in such a way that his primary goal is to leave the door open for them to realize that they can change. So he's not accusational. He doesn't tell them what they do or necessarily what's wrong with them. I mean, he will if it comes up, but that's not his primary agenda. Mm. He's just trying to kind of open the door a crack.
What was it like for you to sort of hang out with him and sit? Because I'm guessing that you as a filmmaker had not sat down with this many, cameras pointed at a member of the KKK or a member of a white separatist group?
Certainly not. I mean, the journey you go on as a viewer kind of parallels our journey, because there were moments when we were repulsed. Mm. But there were also moments when we were genuinely laughing about their interactions, and you almost forget for a minute what you're dealing with.
Right.
It really runs the gamut, because they are, you know, you kind of see three different people. The three of the main Klans people in there are good examples. There's Jeff Scoop, who's the guy with the skinhead, who's like a prominent National Socialist leader who's pretty hardcore. And there's Thomas Robb, the older one, who says some of the worst things in the movie, who's a famous Klan leader.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's Frank Ancona, who's very affable and sort of seems on the verge of a change. And he, unfortunately, was found dead this weekend.
No.
Yeah, just like days ago. And it seems to be not Klan-related, but it just kind of shows the tumult of that world, I suppose.
Have you spoken to Daryl after that happened? Probably.
Daryl let us know that it had happened, and we, of course, you know, feel terrible for his family, but we don't have any more information than the public does yet.
Let's talk about him a little bit, because he's the gentleman who gives a certificate to Daryl, calling him a friend of the organization, and Daryl just asks these questions of him to sort of figure out, because all these men that you've described are motivated by slightly different reasons. Not all of, you know, some of them are trying to avoid what they call a white genocide.
Yeah.
Some of them are trying to create a separate state. Some of them are trying to do something else that I can't quite ascertain. But why are Daryl and Frank friends?
Well, Daryl and Frank's friendship really seemed to be genuine. This is a poor analogy, but for us, it sort of seemed like one of those things where there's friends or family members who love each other, and it's like, oh, we just don't talk about politics, ha-ha.
Right.
It was sort of on that level. They really, you know, cared about what was going on in each other's lives, what was going on with their families, and they were making plans to do things, and that warmth is genuine. That's not something coerced by us. But then they disagree on this single fundamental looming issue.
Right.
And it really did seem to us that of all the people in the film, Frank might be one who did reconsider at some point. He seemed to have the most kind of overt humanity.
He seems the closest to that moment. But we should say, he also says, for America to survive, it needs to be under white Christian rule. He says he was, so this is, he's an imperial wizard from the Traditionalist American Knights. Is that the TAK? Am I getting that name right?
No, he is from the TAK. He is known for some pretty reprehensible things.
Right. Not a Nazi, drawn because of the ritual and the mysteriousness and the intrigue of the organization. But yes, he says some pretty reprehensible things and puts those things in the world and asks other people to join along. So does Daryl just tell people like Frank what they want to hear? How does he sort of get them to listen to him?
I'm so sorry you cut out for 1 second.
Oh, I'm sorry. So, I mean, Daryl, when he sits down, how does he get these people to listen to him? I understand how he listens to them. How does he get them to sort of listen in return?
So Daryl thing with them when he sits down is he really does hear them. Even if he's heard what they're saying many times before or he knows he disagrees with it, he doesn't just like skip ahead to the part where he responds. He really hears them out. Hmm. And so because he does that, they do that for him. And obviously it's more complicated and more nuanced than that, but that was one of the first things that I noticed. Because I'm guilty of the same thing as well. Once I already know I disagree with something, I'm sort of on autopilot a little bit.
And that's the patience thing that you spoke of earlier. He's an incredibly patient person. And then we see his patience fray just a little bit in a conversation with some activists, some younger folks from Black Lives Matter. And they sort of take him to task for not doing enough or not doing the right thing. Tell us a little bit about how Daryl's sort of hobby, if we can call it that, appears to some of the younger activists who are in the cities, marching and demonstrating on a daily basis.
That's a really fascinating scene because you sort of see a generation gap highlighted that I was not as aware of. Mm. Between generations of activists. And, you know, Daryl comes into this scenario and he sees these younger activists who I think are really powerful voices we're hearing a lot from. And Kwame, we've done some screenings with, and I think he's just I think he's great. But, you know, he sees these people that, as far as he's concerned, stand on the shoulders of his generation's accomplishments, and they don't really give him the time of day. From the beginning, they're not really interested in what he is or what he has to say, and so he closes his heart to them, and that's not something we see him do in some of the other scenes.
Right.
So for us as filmmakers, it was surprising as well, but then sort of more understandable once we had time to watch it later and dissect it a bit.
What was he like after, what were all of you like? You all had to have been sort of shaken by that conversation because they sort of turn on you as a group of filmmakers too and say, look at what you're doing here and reconsider it. What are the conversations in the room after that?
Well, certainly people were a little bit shaken. That was the first day of that particular unit of shooting and we were off to the races. But for the core filmmakers, we knew that was a response that happened sometimes that Daryl had told us about. And in the interest of balance, we wanted to get some element of that at some point. Hmm. We didn't know it would be that day. We actually were there to shoot Michael Wood, the police officer turned activist. And Kwame and Tarek and JC kind of came out of that organically. So that day, it wasn't on my list or anything. But once it was happening in front of the cameras, we knew it was something that was going to be important.
How did you decide some of these places to go and visit with Daryl? You're looking for the etching at the Lincoln Memorial that shows the spot where Martin Luther King Jr. stood and gave his famous "I Have a Dream" speech. Right. Trying to find that spot, which is surprisingly, poorly marked. I guess
that was a surprise to me as well. For people that don't know exactly what we're talking about, where Martin Luther King gave the speech, there's a little etching in the ground that if you're looking for it, you can find it.
Right.
But if you weren't there specifically for that, you would never. Uh-huh. And it seems like a glaring omission.
Right. You kind of come up there and he's going to show you where it is. You've never seen it. And there's some people just sort of standing on it, looking at their phones. They don't know.
If nothing else comes out of this movie, I certainly hope we get a better plaque there.
Right. I think so, too. And then there's places like the Lorraine Motel as a museum, Ferguson, Nathan Bedford Forest, the Confederate Park visit. Give me an idea of this journey. Across the country, really, and across history.
You know, at the end of the day, Daryl does what he does because he's curious about these things and he has his own reasons, but he also really loves this country and believes in democracy, and that's one of the things that really brought us, that united Daryl and my fellow filmmakers in the first place. And so we have some of these things that are examples of America at its best, or things to remind us of particularly strong moments or individuals. And then we have these landmarks that become landmarks out of tragedy. They're chosen for the wrong reasons, and those are equally important for us to remember.
And one of the things you do particularly well is sort of juxtapose this footage of some of these people that Daryl sits and, has a cup of coffee with or has a conversation with, some of them who seem, in that conversation, open-minded, more than you might think, and then you sort of flip it with this footage of the hate speech that they are spreading online and in person, and the anger that they have. Jeff Skoop is a great example of that. Wants a white nation state. He's with the Nationalist Socialist Movement. And they are really talking about Elvis Presley and whether or not he invented rock and roll there at the coffee shop. Tell us about that moment.
I mean, that's really interesting, because that's the first time Daryl knew, they both knew who the other one was, but they had not met before. And so whereas some of the other relationships you see are things Daryl's been cultivating for a while, that one's interesting because you see him start from zero. Mm. They're sitting down, they're in a diner, they are very radically opposed on pretty much everything, and Daryl's looking for that common ground.
Right.
And eventually they find it.
But they don't agree on where rock and roll came from.
But that's where, as filmmakers, it's nice because we have a sort of visual counterpoint of Elvis with some of the many black musicians who he not only copied from but also credited.
Right, right. Is there a sense of, you know, some of these Klan's members who turn around, and there has to be a cognitive dissonance between what they're saying, you know, at their meetings and then sitting down with Daryl and saying, oh, but I like this guy.
I mean, the fact that they can compartmentalize like that is interesting. It sort of suggests to me that maybe they don't believe it as strongly as they think they do.
Yeah.
Because the best example is the guy who's not actually in the movie, but a former Klan's leader, who they're asking him why he would go to Daryl's wedding.
His wife.
They ask why he'd go to Daryl's wedding if he's so opposed to interracial marriage. And he says, well, you know, I do it because it's Daryl. And that's not a very good answer.
Yeah.
If this is a belief, what he believes is wrong, but if he believes in it that strongly, you would think it would extend to even a situation involving Daryl.
Yeah.
But the force of personality overcomes it there, which I think shows to me that crack in their philosophy.